You are tuned in to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting live from Burnaby Mountain, BC.
You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. This is the third in a series of shows that is continuing from last month, which was Earth Day. And reminding my listeners that the reason I'm doing this series of shows is that many years ago, in 1980, when I was a student at Queen's University, I launched the first Canadian Earth Day with great enthusiasm and great energy. And now I'm looking back and seeing the impacts and results of that and looking at the state of the environment. And has Earth Day had a positive impact? And where are we now and where are we going? Those are the questions I'm going to try to answer in this series of shows centered on Earth Day. Continuing from our last show, we were seeing how certain people, such as Al Meyerhoff from the Natural Resources Defense Council, who have argued that pesticides cause cancer. So, therefore, we must get rid of pesticides in the food supply if we were to prevent cancer. The logic seems to be that if a risk exists, it ought to be removed. This is naturally an extremely sympathetic, though thoroughly unrealistic attitude. Clearly, anyone with half a brain knows that it is impossible to remove all risks. And far more essential, when we remove one risk, by systems effects, we cause several other risks to pop out, many of which might be worse than the original risk you tried to eliminate. We saw during the discussions on pesticides that if we remove them, then we will naturally avoid, sometime in the future, having any pesticides in our drinking water and on our fruit and on our vegetables. But at the same time, we will get a decrease in agricultural production, perhaps significant decreases, and higher fruit and vegetable prices. And this will make many of these items unavailable to the poor. And since they're no longer getting the fruit and vegetables they need in their diet, they are going to, many of them suffer from malnutrition and other problems. And so you get a situation which is worse than cancer. You have people dying of malnutrition. Simply presenting the direct advantageous consequences of removing pesticides without contemplating the secondary and tertiary effects and the considerable disadvantages resulting leaves us with a very, very poor basis on which to make valid decisions. So therefore, I can state the following. We must wrap our mind around the idea that all decisions are in reality a trade-off of various risks. When we make a choice between chlorinated and unchlorinated water, we choose between the slight risk of getting cancer from chlorine and the many extreme risks of being infected by waterborne diseases that unchlorinated water can easily spread. When we take an aspirin to relieve a headache, we also risk irritation of the stomach lining. And with prolonged use, perhaps we may even get an ulcer. However, in the meantime, we're having our headaches relieved, and it keeps us able to make decisions when we're not under the extreme pain of a headache. We can make clearer decisions. And who knows the effects of not taking the aspirin and suffering the headache on our decision-making capabilities? In effect, we are choosing between the certainty of a headache and the possibility of an irritated stomach. If we go to a bakery, on the other hand, we can choose a Danish pastry at the expense of an extremely small risk of getting killed on the road or from the baker. And if we eat the Danish pastry, we give greater priority to our sweet tooth than to the risk of getting a circulatory disease. It is tempting to wish for an end to all of these risks. With enough money, we could secure everyone pure water supplies without chlorine and subsidize the use of ibuprofen, which is more expensive than aspirin, and it does not have the side effects of aspirin. We could build safer roads and reduce the wait for heart surgery. But the crucial words are, if there was enough money. Cash must also be spent on hip operations, on roundabouts on roads, on public libraries, on overseas development aid. The list of sound, worthy causes is endless. And this forces us, each of us, to choose where we're going to direct our funds on a daily basis. Putting money into one area necessitates that we remove money from another area. That is the nature of having to choose. Next, we have to weigh risks. Prioritizing is made harder by the two tendencies which supplement each other. Psychologically, we have the tendency to underestimate large risks and to overestimate small ones. For example, when parents choose to drive their children the half mile to school, they sincerely believe that they are reducing the risk to their children of the hazard of walking to school. Unfortunately, they now increase the risk that their child will be involved in a car accident, or, equally distressing, that by driving to school, they will hit someone else's child who's chosen to walk to school and thereby involve them in a pedestrian accident. Matter of fact, the risks of this are far greater than the risk of letting your child walk to school. So, parents, in trying to reduce risks for their children, end up increasing risks not only for their children, but for everyone else's child as well. That is the reality. The media have a tendency to focus on the dramatic rather than the everyday risks. This is a dangerous cocktail. For example, every day, thousands of individuals throughout North America die of smoking-related disorders, emphysema, cancer of the lung, and so on. This is a rather widespread and diffuse problem, hidden away in hospitals and hospices in big cities all over North America. However, if this action of dying from smoking-related disorders were concentrated in time and place, for example, putting them all aboard a 747 and having them crash on a daily basis, this would be seen as a terrible risk and something more would be done about it. But since it's diffuse and widespread, it can be safely ignored. Same thing is done with the danger of performing useless cosmetic surgery on infants, namely circumcision. which results in approximately 2 infant deaths per day. If these deaths were concentrated in time and space, so for example, in one playground, you had several, 2 children dying every single day in one playground, something would be done immediately. But since these deaths are diffuse and widespread, they can be safely ignored. For the very purpose of attracting public interest, the media present us with far more stories about tragedies and sudden accidents than one ought to expect if the media simply reflected the mortality statistics. The scientists Combs and Slovic carried out a survey of the newspaper's mention of various causes of death compared with actual mortality figures from statistical reports. They found very little connection. People die 1,000 times more often from ordinary diseases, but murders appear 3 times as frequently in the papers. Plane crashes are overrepresented by almost 12,000 times compared to the deaths caused by smoking. Hence, my metaphor of putting all the smokers every day who were dying onto a 747 and having them daily. That would certainly get attention. The media rarely present us with information about actual risks. In a survey of more than 25 American newspapers, a group of scientists asked for the paper's best articles on environmental risks. As many as 68% of the returned articles did not contain any information on risk. So newspapers and television only give us an indirect impression of the danger, a different phenomena by reason of their frequency. It transpires that we overestimate the risks we read a lot about and underestimate the risks overlooked by the media. At the same time, there is well-documented tendency to underrate sizable risks while overrating minor, dramatic ones. It seems we usually believe that we are fairly immune to the large risks such as cancer from smoking and heart attacks. Coupled to the media's focus on things sensational, this means that we overrate dramatic causes of death such as accidents, killings, botulism, and tornadoes, while at the same time grossly underrating boring problems and risks such as dying from diabetes and asthma. Finally, we have great difficulty handling extremely small risks. The problem appears to be that if we think about the small risks, they have already become much bigger, simply because we have thought about them. An example here is the minuscule risk of dying of cancer of the penis. This is one of the least common cancers, affecting less than 1 in 100,000 males in the United States, and yet the circumcision industry has amplified this risk to almost epidemic proportions, to the point that many parents, when asked to justify their decision to circumcise their helpless infant, are responding, "Oh, I want to prevent cancer of the penis, one of the rarest forms of cancer." They express no concern about future smoking patterns or alcoholism, which produce far larger risks of cancer. Most of my listeners will be familiar with the feeling when you're sitting on an airplane. As soon as you have that thought, "My God, what's that noise?" And the very thinking about it has made the risk grow larger, as your mind's eye sees a desperate pilot in a smoke-filled cockpit, and your heart starts to pound in your chest. Psychologically, therefore, we handle small risks either by making them significant enough to think about, or by making them so insignificant that there's good reason to ignore them. This presents problems, for example, in connection with chemical substances, because their safety levels are set at the magically low limit of 1 to 1 million. Meaning, if 1 million people are subjected to the substance, it would result in a maximum of 1 person's death in the course of a lifetime. How in the world is one to handle this risk as small as one in a million? The answer is we either ignore it or we choose to focus all our mind and heart and soul on it, thus making it psychologically much greater. Both solutions are poor ones. We will have to judge the risks to which we are exposed in a reasonable fashion if we are to prioritize our resources. With the media and the organizations focusing so strongly on pesticides, for example, it is only natural that we start thinking about them and make them psychologically much more significant. But the risk posed by pesticides in drinking water is probably a great deal lower than one in a million. If we drink water that contains small contamination with pesticides at the, for example, the European limit for a whole lifetime, we face the same death risk as if we smoke 1.4 cigarettes, cycle 15 miles, live two months in a brick building, or drink a half liter of wine just once. Now, let me repeat that. Is that if you drink water containing pesticides at the European Economic Community value limit for a whole lifetime, it increases your risk of developing cancer as the same as smoking about two cigarettes in your whole lifetime. Two cigarettes. That's not two cigarettes a day. That's two cigarettes in your whole lifetime. The risks are the same. If the pesticide content is below such a limit value, do they really represent any substantial problem? The answer is no. Many people would argue that risk is not the only factor to be considered in this question of priorities. It is also significant whether the risk was accepted voluntarily or thrust upon this person involuntarily. Getting back to our example of circumcision, the reason why it continues mostly has to do with pure cowardice. It is a risk imposed by one person who does not have to accept the risk on another person who has not consented to take the risk but has to accept the full responsibility and consequences of the risk. If the risk was being suffered and borne by the person making the decision, you can be pretty sure that circumcision would have ended eons ago. But because it is made by one person who does not have to carry the risk, imposed on another person who has no choice but to accept the risk, it continues. Because, let's face it, it is so much easier to have someone else suffer the consequences of our poor decisions than to have us suffer for them ourselves. Investigations have shown that people are often willing to take on a risk that is 1,000 times greater, so long as they do so of their own free will. Parents, in their imaginary world, believe that they have the right to make a decision about someone else's body, and so therefore very easily make that decision, imposing the full risks of the consequences on someone else. If, however, they were being tied up in a torture chamber and forced to take on the risk themselves, they obviously would not feel so good about the decision. The obvious example is choosing to skydive or to go off-piste skiing, but still resenting the much smaller risks from pesticides or food preservatives. Risks that are seen as unavoidable and therefore involuntary. True, involuntary risks make it impossible for the individual to choose optimally. Presumably, skydivers find that the thrills of a free fall outweigh the risks of the free fall extending all the way to the ground, while others would be terrified at the prospect of jumping out of a plane from 10,000 feet. Thus, a society based on forced skydiving would make some people happy, but leave lots of people intensely worried. However, it is important to realize how many of the risks that we ordinarily claim to be voluntary are not, and vice versa. Although driving a car is fairly dangerous, the lack of risk concern is typically explained in terms of its being voluntary. Yet for many people, traveling by car is not really a voluntary choice, given by our need to go to work, go to classes, or go shopping at some distance from available housing. Moreover, some of the most important auto risks are clearly not voluntary. The obvious examples being drunk drivers who may wander onto your side of the road, who kill many people beside themselves, and highway design, which has strong, well-documented effects on crash risks. You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby, and you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, Instructor of Future Studies at Simon Fraser University. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
With thousands of homeless animals entering SPCA shelters each year, pet overpopulation is a serious problem in BC, but it's one you can help prevent. Spay or neuter your companion animal today. From our perspective, every homeless animal on our streets or in our shelters is one too many. For more information on spaying and neutering initiatives, visit the BC SPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional futurist.
Welcome back. We are continuing to look at the environment, and the right now we're looking at risks and the risks that people are willing to put up with concerning environmental contamination and the illogic around such risks. For example, urban air pollution is described as an involuntary risk since we have to breathe. But of course, choosing to locate ourselves or choosing not to relocate within a city is the result of an overall trade-off on many different parameters. Since housing in less polluted areas generally costs more, we are in effect making a trade-off between living in a larger house or breathing cleaner air. This problem is clear in that we often heard the claim that poor or black Americans are more likely to live close to toxic waste dumps and other environmental hazards. Although the connection is true, it is more correctly seen as a problem of poverty, because poor and black Americans are not just environmentally disadvantaged, but also are more likely to live in areas afflicted with high crime, loud noise, and bad infrastructure. Thus, in the following, we shall look at both voluntary and involuntary risks over a wide spectrum of different areas and demonstrate that the extreme focus on environmental risks means that other and larger risks are routinely ignored. So this leads us to the analysis of the costs of associated with environmentalism. The Harvard University Center for Risk Analysis carried out the largest survey of life-saving public initiatives, so-called interventions, in the United States for which there are publicly available economic analyses. In total, almost 600 different interventions were examined. By using an extremely detailed evaluation procedure, at least two researchers out of 11 have computed the cost evaluations and number of life years saved and rendered in figures in comparable form. All of the costs were designed to pertain to society as a whole, so no considerations have been made for possible distributional consequences. The areas investigated covered health care, as well as residential, transportation, occupational, and environmental aspects of society. The aims was to evaluate the individual area's efficiency when it came to saving human lives. It was important to point out that only interventions that had as the primary stated political goal to save human lives were included. Thus, the many environmental interventions which had little or no intention to save human lives were not considered in this Harvard study. They only compared these environmental interventions whose primary goal it was to save human lives, such as toxin control, with life-saving interventions in other areas. Thus, all of the interventions had similar intent and therefore were compatible and could be compared. When the results were tabulated, they revealed an astonishing variation in the efficiency of the various interventions. Some of the initiatives cost nothing or actually saved money. These included, for example, informing black women not to smoke during pregnancy, as this would give fewer birth complications. The net savings for society for doing this intervention was over $70 million U.S. For over 180,000 a year, it was possible to screen black newborns for sickle cell anemia and save almost 800 life years at a cost of just over $200 per life year. By spending just over $250 million on heart transplants, an extra 1,600 life years could be saved at a cost of just over $150,000 per life year. Equipping all school buses with passenger safety belts would cost around just over $50 million. But because this would only save much less than one child a year, the cost would be almost $3 million per life year saved. Regulating radionuclides emission at elemental phosphorus plants, refining mines phosphorus before it goes to other uses, would cost almost $3 million, but would only save at most one life per decade. This gave an estimate of almost $10 million per life year saved. The decision as to how much money should be spent on saving a life year is naturally a political one, and one could, of course, conceive of both refining the measurement. Possibly children life years would count more than adult life years. Female life years would be worth more than male life years. Feminist life years worth more than the average woman's life years, since conceivably they have more to contribute to the welfare of the greater whole, and so on. And challenging some of the figures, the price may be twice as high or half as much. The point that we're making here, however, is to look at typical prices in the various areas. Here it is quite obvious that there are tremendous differences in the price to be paid for extra life years by means of typical intervention. The health service is quite low priced at just under $20,000, and the environmental field stands out at staggeringly high costs of over $4 million per life year saved. So we're going to continue looking at this analysis, putting hard numbers to environmentalism and seeing if it's well worth the cost. Because we only have a limited amount of money, and so we should spend it in the places that'll do the most good. So in future shows, we're going to continue this analysis and see what the future holds for environmentalism. So please stay tuned.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby, and Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.